I have a question. If the angels were made perfect, if they were made perfect, how could one third of them sin? You read that Lucifer was made perfect. Well, if you're perfect, how can you sin? And of course, then how could one third of the angels who were also made perfect who followed him sin? Now, people like to ask questions of God. Some of you have heard the question, thinkers, and I guess I put that term in quotes and use it loosely, like to ask questions like this. Did Adam have a navel? Well, one of the other questions that people ask, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin? I don't know what they think these questions do or what they accomplish, but people like to ask them. And another one is, if God can do anything and is all-powerful, could he create a rock he couldn't lift? Now, you've probably heard me have fun with that question. If God is all-powerful, then you would theorize, if he's all-powerful, he'd be powerful enough to create a rock he couldn't lift. But if he's all-powerful, he could lift it. You see the point? The point is there is no point except to ask a question that causes somebody to think that they have a deep mind and they have an impossible question. Well, I'll ask you a little more pointed and a little more important question about God and what is possible with God. Now remember, we asked the question to start, if the angels were made perfect, how could one third of them sin? I mean, perfect is perfect is perfect, right? Well, maybe not. If, quote, with God all things are possible, Hebrews says this, how is it then that it's impossible for God to lie? That's sort of like, if God is all powerful, could he create a rock he couldn't lift? And you have an oxymoron. It's impossible. Well, if all things are possible to God, why does the same book of Hebrews say it's impossible for God to lie? I think that verse is in Hebrews. With God, all things are possible is not in Hebrews. Now, the answer lies in the definition of character. Both those questions have an answer that lies in the definition of character. Let me give you a definition of character. There are probably several. I'm going to give you two. I'm going to give you a long one and a short one. That'll prove that there are any number of definitions that could be derived. I'm going to give you one that's probably five times longer than the other one, but you'll see that both of them are correct. Here's the longer definition of character. I'll say it slowly in the event you want to write it down, and I hope that you will. The definition of character. It is the ability of a separate entity with a rational mind of free moral agency to come to a knowledge of the truth of any matter and make the choice to go that way. We're almost done. And resist the wrong way of which one is equally aware. Of which a person is equally aware. It is the ability of a separate entity with a rational mind of free moral agency to come to a knowledge of the truth of any matter and make the choice to go that way and resist the wrong way of which one or a person is equally aware. That's the long definition or a long definition of character. Here's a short one. This one has six words. Here's a short definition of character. Doing what's right against a countering resistance. Doing what's right against a countering or a counter resistance. Turn to 2 Peter, if you would, please. 2 Peter. I have often said the greatest single lesson I learned in the 1990s, and it may be the single greatest lesson I've learned in my entire life, is that when presented with the choice of doing right and wrong, you may remember the last sentence of my booklet, Why the Restored Church of God, when presented with a clear choice between right and wrong, most people will not choose to do what's right. They won't. And the reason they won't lies in the problem of character, not judgment. Most people do what's wrong because they lack the character to do what's right, not the knowledge of what's right. Most people who do what's right do it because they have the character to do what's right, not because they have just the knowledge of what is right. I flipped the coin over and said the exact same thing in a different way. Now in 2 Peter chapter 1 and verse 2, Peter writes, "Grace and peace be multiplied unto you through the knowledge of God and of Jesus our Lord. According as His divine power has given unto us all things that pertain unto life and godliness, through the knowledge of Him that has called us to glory and virtue." Virtue. That's the old King James word for character. Now, a lot of people talk about being bound for glory. I've given sermons about it at the feast. They are headed for glory. Now, they don't necessarily know what glory is. Glory to them may be going to heaven and riding clouds, you know, rolling around heaven all day, walking the streets of gold in front of the pearly gates, or playing harps or singing. But in some fashion, they see that as glory, and if they're a Christian, they're bound for it. That's the way they feel. They've been called to glory, and they will often cite 2 Peter 1:3. Again, the problem becomes, what is glory? And this sermon isn't about that word, but the other word that it says we are called to. Now, when people think of their calling, they think of their calling to be a Christian. I've already said they think of their calling to glory, even out in the world. They think of their calling to certain understanding. And, of course, we come to understand that the glory we're called to is to rule cities in the world tomorrow. And that really is glorious, and we're excited about it. We're called to glory. I mean, it does say it. And we have the right definition of it. But most people do not think that they are called to character. That they are, in fact, called to virtue. Now, one of the most exciting booklets I ever read, and by the way, it's one that my wife is telling me, you know what, we need to write this one. People ask me, Mr. Pack, when are we going to write this one? When are we going to write that one? I tell them one at a time. Again, I often say I envy Mr. Armstrong. He had 8 months for every booklet. And 8 days looks good to me right now, the way we're going. So I don't know when we will write it, but I know it's a high priority, and it's entitled, Why Were You Born? Because the answer to that question, if you were going to give it a short form, and that's the medium to long size one of Mr. Armstrong's booklets, is that we were called to glory and virtue. We were called to build character. Nobody ever taught me, my father had character and he taught about character, but nobody ever taught me that the purpose for my life was to build the character of God until I heard Mr. Armstrong say it. I'd never heard that. I understood it was a good thing to do as a citizen of America. And my dad used to tell me about certain coaches he had as an athlete who taught him to have character, and that it was important in life. But I never understood it was the purpose for my birth until I read the booklet, Why Were You Born? And I learned God was reproducing Himself and He was building character in people. And of course, the old King James word there again is virtue. Verse 4, whereby are given unto us exceeding great and precious promises. Well, that's the glory. That by these promises that God will give us eternal life, if we qualify for it, we will inherit marvelous, wonderful, precious things, if we qualify for it, you might be partakers of the divine nature. Now, we talk about human nature. Everybody knows what human nature is. Natural comes from the word nature. Everybody knows what nature is. Pretty soon, a lot of people will be out walking in nature because nature will be very beautiful. In about 30 days, there'll be bees and butterflies and dandelions and blossoms and maybe some leaves if it's an early spring and so forth out there. It'll be fun to be in nature. Everybody knows what the word natural means. So whether it's human nature, it's what's natural to humans, or divine nature, what's natural to God, and part of God's nature is He cannot lie. It's impossible for Him to lie. Why? Because He said He won't, and He has character. And if God makes a decision and has perfect character and says, I will not lie, even though it would be possible for God to lie if He didn't have character, but with His character He can't, then He won't. And it's part of His divine nature. But again, continuing the verse, having escaped the corruption that is in the world through lust, verse 5, and beside this, having escaped, giving all diligence, add to your faith virtue. Now, the very first thing a Christian has to have is faith. Human faith, at the time of baptism and conversion, that Christ will pay for his sins. If you don't have human faith, you're not even going to believe enough to get in the water. And that God will, in fact, give you His Spirit. You can't say, well, I have the faith of God's Spirit that I'll receive God's Spirit. Well, that's impossible. You can't have the faith that comes from God's Spirit that you're going to receive His Spirit until you receive His Spirit. So the first thing you have to have is faith. Then immediately, after you receive God's Spirit, you have God's faith. You have human faith. Go read Romans 1:16-17, and that's another subject. But the Bible plainly says we go from faith to faith in this life. It takes human faith to believe that Christ will cover our sins. So I've never heard of human faith. Well, sure you have. When Christ healed unconverted people, He said, your faith has made you whole. And He said, according to your faith be it unto you. And He said those to people who did not have God's Spirit. They had human faith. So he that comes to God must believe that he is. Hebrews 11:6. The very first thing we do when we come to God is believe that he is. That's why it is so important we write this booklet, Does God Exist? And the people absolutely know that God exists because our job is to show them how to come to him. And if we haven't convinced them that He exists and that you can prove it, then what's the point of coming to Him? Because God says, if you don't believe He is, you can't please Him. Without faith, you can't please Him. Again, read Hebrews 11:6. So the very first thing is faith. The very next thing a Christian is supposed to focus on is the importance of building virtue or character. Very next thing after faith. It couldn't be ahead of faith. Because you have to have faith that God is working with you, in you, helping you build that character. That should be very, very clear, and I hope that it is. Now, verse 12, Peter writes, wherefore I will not be negligent to put you always in remembrance of these things, though you know them and be established in the present truth. Now let's examine that verse for a moment briefly. I don't know how many times I heard Mr. Armstrong talk about the importance of building character. And he kept coming back to God is reproducing himself. Again, none of us ever heard that in our previous religions, that God is reproducing himself. That we don't just look like him in shape, but we look like him in character. Now, this is 7 verses after we read about character. And of course, it talks about knowledge, temperance, patience, godliness, brotherly kindness, and love, and so forth, and how these things ought to be in us and abound. Then Peter says, wherefore I will not be negligent to put you always in remembrance of these things. And brethren, Mr. Armstrong was never negligent. Neither was Peter. Peter regularly stressed these things. The days of unleavened bread are about putting the wrong things out of our life and putting the right things in. And we need to regularly, or if you will, always be put in remembrance of these things. A lot of ministers, and perhaps myself at times, although I think I prepared this sermon, or a similar sermon, very similar to it, many years ago, and I decided every pastor I go to, I'm going to give this sermon and read this verse. So I can tell you, I've never pastored a single church, and I made a lot of mistakes, but every church I have ever pastored, I read this verse fairly early on when I got there and said, I am not going to be negligent. You're going to hear me talk about these things. And I did it. And I'm holding my notes up here. Most of these notes were created in the 70s on this particular sermon. Now, is it because people don't know that they're supposed to build character? I guess if you go long enough and the ministry is negligent enough to not put people in remembrance, yes, they can forget them. But Peter says, though you know them. Now, brethren, you know we were born to build the character of God, but that does not mean you should not be regularly put in remembrance of that calling, because we were called, yes, to glory, but we were also called to character, to build character. Now, the angels were perfect, but they didn't have perfect character. They never overcame human nature or fleshly angel nature because they weren't flesh. They never overcame the world because there was no rotten world, and they didn't overcome the power of the devil because there was no devil. Character is overcoming the flesh, the world, and the devil. The angels were made perfect but didn't overcome any of those, let alone all of them. So they were as perfect as you could be until up rose the devil and 1/3 of them sinned. Do you now understand? They had no character. They just hadn't sinned. They had never resisted anything. And the first time they were given an opportunity to resist, they flopped. So the angels were perfect, but they didn't have perfect character is the answer to if the angels were made perfect. Remember the first question, how could 1/3 of them sin? Now, the second question, I touched on it again later, but I'll say it again. If with God all things are possible, how is it that it's impossible for God to lie? God is perfect, but God does have character. So he wills in his mind what he's going to do, and he does it because he's not just perfect but has perfect character. Do you see the difference? The angels were perfect and wound up lying. God is perfect and will never lie. Why? Because he has perfect character and they didn't. Now let's go on. The Apostle Paul was struggling in Romans chapter 7. Struggling terribly, frankly. Romans chapter 7. And verse 15. Romans 7 and verse 15. And we could pick it up almost anywhere in the chapter to get the flow of what Paul was talking about. It might even be good to pick it up in verse 12. Paul said, wherefore the law is holy, and the commandment holy and just and good. Was then that which is good made death unto me? I mean, here the law is good, but when I look at the law, I find I sin, and I'm under the death penalty. How could something good bring death? God forbid. It's not the law that brings the death. It's our sin. Some say, you know what? The law points out sin. This is what 1.2 billion people believe who are Christian. They believe this. The law points out sin, and sin's bad, so get rid of the law, and you have nothing to point out sin. That would be like saying, everybody runs stop signs, and you can get a ticket for running stop signs, so solve the problem. Get rid of all the stop signs, and you can't be guilty of running a stop sign. That's true. You can't run red lights if you tear down all the red lights. That's exactly what the Christians of this world have decided. So Paul says, no, the law is holy and just and good. Was then that which is good, the law is good. One of the most famous evangelists who ever lived called them the Terrible Ten. Made death unto me? God forbid. No. No, it's not the law that brought death, but sin, that it might appear sin. Now, sin can only appear as sin if you've got a law to point it out. You'd only be guilty of running a stop sign if the officer can say, did you see that stop sign over there? Did you see that you ran through? Did you see you ran through that red light? No officer can convict somebody of that unless they can point back at a light or a sign they ran. You understand what I'm saying? It's so basic. Why is it 1.2 billion people? These are the ones who claim to be Christian. Some say there's 2 billion, and that may be true. There's 1 billion Catholics, and probably it is true that it's closer to 2 billion. That's one-third of the people on earth. Working death in me, back in the middle of verse 13, by that which is good. Now, the law's good. Sin isn't. And sin works death in me by that which is good, the law. The law is pointing it out. That's good. You can see what sin is. Not death isn't good. That sin by the commandment might become exceeding sinful. The more you focus on the commandment, the more you realize, you know, there's a lot of sin in my life. I'm exceeding sinful. Verse 14. For we know that the law is spiritual. It's not bad. But I am carnal, sold under sin. I am carnal, sold under sin. I'm physical. That's the problem. The law is spiritual, and we're physical. I often counsel people for baptism, and I have fun with them. Now, maybe you've heard me say this in sermons. I don't remember the last time I said it, but here's often what I will do. I will say to people the following when I'm counseling them for baptism. Matter of fact, I counseled somebody just the last week, and I asked this question. Do you see certain things in your human nature? And they'll say, oh, yes, I see it. Vanity, jealousy, lust, and greed. I said, do you ever see hatred? Oh, yeah. How about anger? Oh, yeah. Impatience, resentment? Sure, I do. You ever proud? You ever foolish? You deceitful? Oh, yeah, yeah. But I'm overcoming those things. That's why I want to be baptized. Often people say, I'm doing better. I'll say, oh, you are. Well, that's interesting. So you're doing better. Do you have God's Spirit? No. I say, but, and this is what we'll do. We'll have a little fun. I try to keep a straight face. I'll say, well, now, okay, you don't have God's Spirit, but you are overcoming them. I said, well, you know what? You don't need to be baptized. I don't often run into people like you, but you're one of the few people that just really doesn't need God's Spirit to overcome. And then I smile. What do you mean? What do you mean? I said, well, wouldn't you say that vanity, jealousy, lust, and greed, wouldn't you say that those are spiritual problems? Yes. I said, well, do you have God's Spirit? No. I said, well, can you overcome spiritual problems with physical weapons? Well, no. I said, well, but you've found a way to do it. And then they smile, and they realize they've been had, and we laugh together. And I said, all right, now let's talk about how the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? And you just proved it. And I tell them, you've even fooled yourself about whether or not you're able to grow without actually having God's Spirit. So the law of God cannot help you grow. It is a spiritual law with spiritual overtones, and it requires the Spirit of God to keep it. Paul said, I'm carnal, sold under sin. For that which I do, now Paul was converted, but he still had a fleshly mind, I allow not. I don't want to do it, but I do it. For what I would, that do I not, and what I hate, that I do. Now, character can only be defined as correctly exhibited in two ways. God says don't do something, and you don't do it, and everything else that God says to do is something He says to do, and you do it. There's only two kinds of instructions God gives: things you don't do, and things you do do. Now, most people take the things they're told not to do and do them, and they take the things that they're told to do and don't do them. And those are people that don't have character. So that's exactly what Paul said. I mean, try to think of anything in life, anything in the Christian walk, which is not a do or a don't. And most people make the do's into don'ts and the don'ts into do's in their life. They don't want to. They don't mean to, but they do. And Paul had God's Spirit, and he saw that's exactly what he did. He saw, even the things I hate, I do. He didn't have perfect character, but he was striving. If then I do that which I would not, I don't want to do it, I consent unto the law that it's good. I'm saying the law tells me it's wrong. Don't do it. Now, I do it anyway, but I'm saying the law says don't do it, and I don't want to do it. I'm saying the law's good. Professing Christianity says, the law says don't do it. I'm not able to overcome it. I don't have God's Spirit or whatever. I'm not progressing, so chuck the law. Throw out the law. Get rid of it. Verse 17, now then it is no more I that do it, but sin that dwells in me. Paul did not identify with himself. He identified with Christ's Spirit in him. He says, not me anymore. It's just not even me. When I sin, it's not me. Yes, he took responsibility, because he went on in verse 18 and said, for I know that in me, that is in my flesh, dwells no good thing. And brethren, there's nothing good in our flesh. For to will is present with me. I say, I will not do this. You know, we talk about the human will. I will not do it. It's present with me. But how to perform that which is good, I find not. Sometimes he just slipped. For the good that I would, I do not. But the evil which I would not, that I do. And this was one of the greatest servants of God of all time speaking. Now if I do that I would not, it is no more I that do it, but sin that dwells in me. Paul was able to disassociate his will and what he was striving to slowly become from what he still found himself periodically doing or not doing, whatever the case would be, that was wrong. It was so powerful a picture in Paul's mind, this building of character, this internal, ongoing, continuous struggle of being called to virtue, that he said in verse 21, I find then a law that when I would do good, you might add, try to do good, evil is present with me. It's the harder I try, it's automatically evil. Now, there was a way that he overcame it. He did overcome. So how then is this a law? Keep reading. For I delight in the law of God after the inward man. But I see another law in my members warring against the law of my mind and bringing me into captivity to the law of sin which is in my members, in my body, in my arms and legs and everything about me. There's two different laws at war in you, brethren, and if you've never figured that out, and I suspect most of you have, identify it, recognize it, figure it out, address it. O wretched man that I am, who shall deliver me from the body of this death? This body where he said, in my flesh dwells nothing good. Verse 25, I thank God through Jesus Christ our Lord. So then with that mind, with the mind, he means that mind, I myself serve the law of God. But with the flesh, my flesh, the law of sin. Two different laws, the law of God and the law of sin. And chapter 8 talks about, verse 6, to be carnally minded is death, but to be spiritually minded is life and peace. Carnal mind is enmity against God, it's not subject to the law of God, neither indeed can be. Verse 8, so then they that are in the flesh cannot please God. It was a struggle. Human nature will pull with tremendous power against the character that we must all build to do what's right. But Paul got on top of himself. He did. 1 Corinthians chapter 9 proves that. You might turn over there. I have learned One man once said, the Bible is hard on its heroes. I think that's probably true. I don't remember who said it, but I remember hearing it many, many years ago. It is true. God, for his own reason, shows the foot of clay of all of his greatest servants so that all of us can understand, you know, if they can do A or B or C or be guilty of X or Y or Z, or maybe some of God's greatest servants were guilty of A, B, C, X, Y, and Z, all of them, then there's hope for me. There's hope for me. Most people beat themselves up terribly, and they shouldn't. They should recognize that a lot of the greatest servants of God made terrible mistakes, and they can overcome just as much as those could. Know you not, 1 Corinthians 9, that they which run in a race run all, but one receives the prize? So run that you may win. And every man that strives for the mastery, that's the championship, is temperate in all things. Athletes have to be that way. They really have to be very temperate. I look back in some ways at my childhood and I wish I had not done certain things because I had this goal of a certain championship and I restricted myself in ways you just would not believe, and I did it for years. And so maybe sometime I'll write about it or talk about it. It's its own story. But it was what you do out there in the world if you have certain goals. And I put a straitjacket on certain things in my life that were just wrong to do. I thought they were right, and believe me, I was temperate beyond all bounds in certain ways. It was just unnatural and unbalanced and wrong, but I had this carnal goal that I wanted to achieve certain things, and I was told the way to do it out there in the world was to do what I was told. The Isthmian Games and the Greek Games and other games that Paul was familiar with, that people who were reading this epistle would have been familiar with, would make this an excellent analogy, comparing Christianity to winning an event, a championship at those games. Now they do it, they in the world do it to obtain a corruptible crown. Now watch what people will do to win a Super Bowl, to win a World Series, a Stanley Cup, an NBA championship, or the Grand Slam in tennis or golf or whatever. It's amazing what they will do. I therefore so run, not as uncertainly, so fight I, not as one that beats the air. Paul said, I'm not shadow boxing. You know what shadow boxing is? It's punching the air. I told you a few weeks ago, my dad taught me when I was little to shadow box. And Paul said, I fight. I do fight. But he said, I don't shadow box. I don't just beat the air. When I throw a punch, it lands. That's exactly what he said. But I keep under my body, now read on, and bring it into subjection. I keep under my body means I strike myself under the eye. Paul said, if I have to, I give myself a black eye. You ever heard the term? He gave himself a black eye. You're going to give yourself a black eye. You know where that comes from? Right there. The Greek there means, Paul said, so fight I. I throw a punch, hit myself right under the eye, and I keep myself in subjection. That's what keep under my body means. It's very poorly translated. And bring it under subjection. Not because he was striving to win an event at the Isthmian Games or the Olympics, but because of the great prize he was going after. He was running to win. Lest that by any means, when I have preached to others, I myself should be a castaway. Now, when we were reading what Paul wrote to the Romans, we were reading about a person who said, boy, I try, and what I don't want to do, I do, and what I do, what I do, don't want to do, and I don't, and so forth. Now he's saying, I do keep under my body. I smack myself, I give myself a black eye whenever I need to. Left hook, right cross, jab, whatever I need, that's what I do. I bring it into subjection. That sounds very different than the person who said, I just can't do what I want to do, what I should do. And it was so that he would not be a castaway. He understood that without character, he could preach all he wanted, but he'd be a castaway. He would be cast away by God. You know what a castaway is? Now, if you're gathering, panning for gold, and you're trying to find nuggets in the stream, and you're sifting in the pan, and there's lots of gravel in there, you cast away the gravel and you keep the gold. God is going to cast away. I could take you to a number of verses that talk plainly about God is going to literally cast away certain people. They shall be cast into outer darkness. I could just show you a whole variety of verses. Paul knew exactly what the word cast away meant. No mystery. And he knew it came down to whether or not he built character. Now, we live in an age when people are no longer interested in building character. They're interested in their rights. They're interested in who can die with the most toys. They're interested in accumulating possessions. They're interested in who they know, where they live, what they've done, where they've been, and so forth. They're not interested in building character. But there will be this little group of people scattered around the world who will understand that they've been called to glory and virtue. Some people in their life can't say no when they should say no. Or if the need is, as we've been talking about both sides of this, they can't say yes when the answer is yes. They just can't. Consider those who cannot say no. There are people who cannot say no to food. Now, the people who get more press are the anorexics and the bulimics and some of the others who basically need to eat more. We think of people like Karen Carpenter and certain others who become very gaunt. And it's virtually a plague among young teenage girls because their lives are so splashed full of all these different pictures of all these incredibly slender girls, many of whom, these models, are literally drugged with appetite suppressants, so they won't eat and they look thinner. Now, of course, trends change and then models want to look a little fuller. But the problem is there are some people who have the opposite problem and you don't hear much about it anymore. Although I read an article about 10 days ago, people can't say no to food. 60% of the people in this country are overweight. 60%. And the number that went up, and I wish I had written it down, I actually did cut the article out, and I don't know where I put it, but the number over the last decade, you know, every 10 years, they do certain studies with the census and so forth. I don't know whether it's a census-related study, but a lot of people now are overweight in numbers. The 10 years ago, they were not, or whatever number of years it was. I'm not sure. It seems like it was a 10-year study. It's easy to overeat. Just walk into the kitchen and just overeat. You know, I used to tell people I was a skinny glutton. I didn't, you know, some people eat it today and wear it tomorrow. I'm not that way. I could eat all day long and 30 minutes after I stop, be wasting away. And that's just me. But some people cannot say no. Some people can't say no to tobacco. They cannot say no to alcohol. They cannot do it. Not that we should say no. We don't have to abstain, but it's got to be temperate. Some cannot say no to illicit sex. They can't do it. Lust just pull them all over the place. They can't say no. Others can't say no to the desire to just keep on sleeping. They just want to continue to count sheep, I guess, and they don't want to get out of bed. And you know all the proverbs about the sluggard, and he turns on his bed like a door on hinges and so forth. Some people cannot say no to their temper. They can't say no to what they want to buy. They can't say no to drugs. They can't say no to gossip. They have a story, they just have to get it out. They just can't say no. They can't say no to themselves on anything. It's phenomenal. We live in an age when people simply don't have the strength that they used to have. If somebody treats them a little bit unfairly on the job, you can't do that, I'm out of here. And they're gone. Gone are the days when Dad went off to work at the railroad and 40 years later he retired from the railroad. He went off to work at a factory and 40 years later he retired. Same place. The thought of being in one place for 40 years because you endure the ups, the downs, the good times, the bad times, the changes in supervisors, working conditions, and everything else. You start in a place, you end there, your whole life's there, you look forward to your pension. I'm not saying that's the only way to do it. I'm just saying it doesn't happen very often today. I don't know, maybe it does sometimes, but it's so rare now because people won't take anything. They won't endure anything. They won't put up with anything. Same with marriage. used to be people would stay together for the sake of the kids. They would just hang in there. They'd say, wait a minute, we took a vow. We're going to just stay together because they had the character. Now it's, you know, I think I can do better. Or I'm tired or whatever. You see, I mean, I you all see that. Now, turn to Proverbs 25 and verse 28. Proverbs 25 and verse 28. Putting leaven out of our life is not a seven-day proposition. It is not a seven-day requirement. It is pictured as a seven-day season because it pictures a way of life. You will find that essentially God's holy days fall into two patterns. They either represent a season of days like the Feast of Tabernacles and the Days of Unleavened Bread, or they represent a single event. The ones that are a single day represent a single event. The ones that last 7 days, like Tabernacles and Unleavened Bread, picture a period of time. The millennium for the Feast of Tabernacles, and also a way of life for our whole life for the Days of Unleavened Bread. That's why God gives the Days of Unleavened Bread 7 days. It's not a one-day event. The Passover is a one-day feast. Passover is a feast. It's a one-day event. It's a memorial. It's an annual event. So God wouldn't say there'll be the 7 days of Passover. The Feast of Trumpets pictures a series of very closely contracted events. So it gets 1 day in God's plan. And the same with Pentecost. You can follow it through. I think you understand. Now, in Proverbs 25 and verse 28... we recognize, probably a lot of people in the world recognize this principle. If only they'd open their Bibles, they'd see what God has said for a long time, and that is, he that has no rule over his own spirit, his own attitude, his own mind, is like a city that is broken down and without walls. If you can't control yourself, if you don't have character, remember, doing what's right against counter-resistance? If you can't control yourself, you're a city without walls. The city isn't broken, the walls are. It's broken down in its defenses without walls. In other words, it's exposed. The only thing that protects a city from a lot of city-states, if you understand the way the Bible describes cities in the past, they had walls around them, they kept bandits out, they kept wild animals, marauders, and others out, armies sometimes. The walls were the defense. You know what your defense is in life? Your walls? It's character. It's character. If you walk through a mall, it's only character that says, you know what? I got to have that $500 watch, or I've got to have that 36-inch television, or whatever it is. When you've already got a 32-inch or a 22 or whatever it is, you've already got a nice television, I've got to have a better and better and better car. I'm not going to be happy till I'm driving a Mercedes. Some people, it's their thing. They have to do it. They have to go on to something else. Only could be food, drugs, clothes, sex, jobs, another mate, tobacco, whatever. When they feel their spirit getting angry, they get angry. They don't stop it. They're defenseless. They have no walls. A person who is building character is a person who is building walls in their life. Now let me just ask you. Let me ask you. Whatever you're addressing, are you building walls to protect you? This world wants in. Your flesh wants in. And trust me, the devil wants in. Are you building walls? Because without control or rule over your spirit, you are defenseless. You have no walls. I didn't say that. God did. What are you doing? What are you building? You and I are not going to get through the age that lies ahead without walls. Practice telling yourself, I'm in the business of building, maintaining, repairing, strengthening, deepening, heightening, and regularly checking for cracks, the walls that I am building, should have built, and must continue to build. There were times when Jerusalem had three different walls around it. I've stood on some of those walls. I've studied pictures of them. Fascinating. When the Assyrians came in and laid siege to Jerusalem, virtually every single city, I've toured many of the cities of Israel, it's fascinating. Walls around all of them. The greatest soldiers, the greatest generals in the Middle East were those who were masters of siege warfare. They knew how to bring a siege against a city. Because if a city was smart, it took a lot of goods inside, built up its walls, and said, "You can't get to us." That's what the whole story of the Masad is about. It's the story of the Battle of Lachish, the Battle of Jerusalem. It's fascinating. It's the whole story of the Battle of Nineveh. The Babylonians figured out how to get through the walls. And when Babylon collapsed, the Persians figured out how to get through the walls. When people collapse, it's because their enemies figured out how to get through the walls. That's exactly what it's about. They didn't repair their walls. They took care of physical things instead of spiritual things. An awful lot of people were partying for years rather than maintaining and building their walls. And along came a massive nuclear attack, and a lot of people who thought they were strong didn't have walls at all. They hadn't laid the first course of brick. Or whatever walls they had could just be stepped over, and they were destroyed. Proverbs 16 and verse 32. "He that is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he that rules his spirit than he that takes a city." Now in the world, you're considered great if you conquer cities. We've just been talking about conquering cities. Alexander the Great sat down at age 32 and wept because he was quoted as saying, "There's no more worlds left for me to conquer." And he died at age 32. Some say 33. He took city after city. Hitler was so excited. And the films rolled, the cameras flashed because he did a jig. He did a little German jig in the city of Paris to have captured his mortal enemy's capital, Paris. And in the background, you saw pictures of hundreds of thousands of French weeping. The Maginot Line didn't hold up. It wasn't a big enough wall. Out in the world, you are rewarded for taking cities. In God's scheme of things, you are rewarded for defending cities. Do you understand the difference between those two verses? Do you understand? In the world, it's can you go conquer cities? Can you go take a city? God's instruction to people who are building character is can you successfully defend your city? Because everybody out there is trying to take it. You're going to keep your walls strong? Because if you can rule your spirit, you are greater than anyone who comes against your city to take it. Brethren, do you understand those verses? You are either going to build your walls, keep them strong. There were five walls around Nineveh. Or was it three Nineveh and five Babylon? One of them, I remember one had three and one had five. Nineveh had one wall that was 60 feet high. Of course, they were defeated because a Babylonian engineers came in, and you know what happened. Basically, they captured the reservoir, let it loose, and the reservoir flooded the city, and the city was made out of red bricks, and the whole city turned to goo and literally collapsed. The mightiest city the world had ever seen, Nineveh, built by Nimrod, just turned into a whole pile of goo because somebody outthought them. And believe me, our enemies are trying to figure out how to outthink us and take us out, whether it's your flesh, whether it's the world, or whether it's the devil himself. He is sitting and trying to figure out how to take your city, and God is saying, are you going to keep your walls strong or not? And you do it through character. That's exactly what both of those verses say. And I cannot stress it enough. Let's put it in an even more extreme condition. Turn to Luke 9. Let me give you a more extreme analogy. Luke chapter 9. I'm telling you, brethren, the whole world lies asleep. They have no clue what is happening, where this world is going. That's why I felt so strongly I had to do that booklet next. The trouble that's going on in the Middle East right now, if you've even watched the last 5 and 6 days, is absolutely phenomenal. Where it's going to end, I don't know. I mean, I know in the long run where it's going to end. Oh, I have no doubt about that. I know exactly what God said. I just don't know the short run because it is so turbulent, so explosive, so confusing, so complex. Luke chapter 9, verse 60. Jesus said unto him, "Let the dead bury the dead, but go you and preach the kingdom of God." And another also said, "Lord, I will follow you, but let me first go bid them farewell, which are at home in my house." Now look, I'm willing to be a Christian, but let me take some time off, kind of get myself ready for this, and just go party a couple last times. That's really what the problem was. And Jesus said unto him, "No man, having put his hand to the plow and looking back, is fit for the kingdom of God." Doesn't say, "No man, having put his hand to the plow and going back, is fit for the kingdom of God." Just looking back, like Lot's wife. There's nowhere it says Lot's wife wanted to go back to Sodom and Gomorrah. She may have been on the absolute dead run, head down, with her husband and daughters, and just glanced back and turned to salt. And that is supposed to be a lesson for us, brethren. We're not supposed to look back. It's full speed ahead. That is a complete commitment of will to a particular direction. And there's no turning back. There's not even room for hesitation. Look at 1 Timothy chapter 6. 1 Timothy 6. "Now someday it will actually be time to flee. And when you flee this world," I'm telling you, and you've heard the sermons on the subject, "I am telling you circumstances will develop in such a way," I am telling you, this is absolutely true prophetically, "that most Christians, the ones who are lukewarm, are going to say it's the wrong time. And when we flee, there will be that moment where we will have an opportunity to take off, however God lays it out, where He says, now, go. Will you look back? Will you look back, or will you be so single in character?" I can tell you that most Christians, true Christians, again, of the seventh era, yes, but true Christians, keeping the commandments of God and having the testimony of Jesus, will say it's the wrong time, they're nuts, they're a cult. Don't follow them. They think they're following what Herbert Armstrong said, we're following what Herbert Armstrong said, don't follow them. I mean, the Bible is so plain on that. You've seen all the scriptures. The majority of true Christians will not go. 1 Timothy 6:18. "They that do good, that they be rich in good works, ready to distribute, willing to communicate," verse 17 really set the pace, "charge them that are rich in this world, that they be not high-minded, nor trust in uncertain riches," and so forth. Verse 19, "laying up in store for themselves a good foundation against the time to come." You are building character, laying a foundation of character. We in this age, you, me, in this age, are laying a foundation of character against a terrible time to come, brethren, that they may lay hold on eternal life. You just grab hold of it and you hold on. Someday it will actually be time to flee. God will not leave us in the dark. We will have to be ready to go, and we will have to be literally ready to go. We'll have to be ready to go, and we'll have to be ready to go. Do you understand the difference? Philippians 2 and verse 12. "Wherefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, not as in my presence only," a lot of people only do what they're supposed to do when the boss is around. A lot of people follow the speed limit when there's a policeman nearby, when they're in a radar trap. A lot of people serve and they're wonderful at services when the minister's around. I saw a lot of those people, and you know what? They're all gone. You know, they're gone. Most of them are gone. They're just gone because the ministers are gone. And they only did it when they were in his presence. They weren't building character in their own life. They just did it when Paul was around or when their pastor was around. But now much more in my absence. The test of character is when the cat's away, do the mice play? In the world, that's exactly what happens. Is the boss watching? Is the IRS going to catch me if I cheat on my taxes? Are they going to catch me? Come on, they're not going to catch me. Their presence isn't here. That's the way people live. But now much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God which works in you both to will and to do of His good pleasure. God will help you both will and do. Both will and do. Now, you might say in your mind, I want to do what's right. I only need help with doing it. Let me just stop you right there and say you're kidding yourself. You're kidding yourself if you think you have summoned the will to do what's right and God only helps you do it. Because the Bible says God works in you both to will and to do. Human beings do not naturally want to obey God. I could show you verses. None seeks God. The carnal mind is enmity against God. People do not naturally love God, naturally want to do what God says. Baloney. They don't. That's ridiculous. For it is God which works in you both to will and to do. I mean, it's very explicit, His good pleasure. God first gives you the desire to do it, and then He gives you the ability to do it, to build His character. You can't go out and do it on human steam. So let me just tell you, it's a noble thing to run out into your life and start slapping bricks together and building a wall around you. And there are people who do that. There are people who quit smoking every year and they don't know God. There are people who go on diets and lose weight and don't know God. There are people who go to Alcoholics Anonymous. They talk about a different God. They don't know God. There are people who overcome the desire to sleep too much. They get rid of drugs. They stop doing physical things without the power of God. But spiritual problems cannot be overcome without the power of God. There are people who physically keep the Sabbath. They're called Jews and Seventh-day Adventists, and they do it without God's Spirit. Usually wind up worshiping the Sabbath rather than the God who gave it, but you understand. They keep the Sabbath. They do certain physical things. It doesn't take the Spirit of God to stop eating pork. That's a physical act. Or to not eat shrimp anymore, you see. Those are physical acts. But spiritual battles require spiritual weapons. And of course, God will even help you with those physical things as well. It's just that when I hear people who have God's Spirit say they can't overcome certain physical things, I say, you're kidding yourself. You're lazy. Because people in the world who don't have God's Spirit overcome a lot of physical things. And you have God's Spirit. Now, we're the weak of the world. But let me tell you something. The weak of the world with God's Spirit can overcome things easier than the strong of the world who don't have it. Would you doubt that? You're saying that strong-willed people have more strength than the power of God in weak people. We're the weak of the world if you believe otherwise. That just doesn't wash. With God, all things are possible. Paul said, I can do all things through Christ which strengthens me. And, of course, Christ Himself understood that He could of His own self do nothing. You know those three verses. Let's get right down to this thing of character. Let's just get right down to it for the last portion of the sermon. Let's look at 12 different points or ways of measuring character. There's many others, but let's see if we can define character in a way where you can go home and sink your teeth more clearly into how to build character, as for everybody outside this room, as you exit the days of unleavened bread. So you don't go right back into Egypt. Number one, character does not do everything it can do. It does not do everything it can do. Now, what does that mean? Paul said he had freedom, he had certain liberty in Christ, but he didn't take advantage of that liberty. He knew that if he was in the presence, for instance, of a vegetarian, he wasn't going to bite into a big piece of prime rib. He did not want to offend his weak brother. So it takes character to do that. It takes character to say, I'm going to be concerned about somebody else. If somebody else is an alcoholic, I'm not going to sip wine in front of them every time I'm around them. I mean, if they're trying to overcome alcohol. We have alcoholics who have to take the Passover every year. And they have to take a little bit of wine. They literally do. Maybe it's just to dab it on their tongue. They have to do it or they have no part with Christ. That's tough. Many of us who've never overcome or had to overcome alcohol might not understand that. I might have just told you something you were not aware of or thought of before. But I can tell you I've counseled many, many alcoholics facing their first Passover who've been on the wagon for years, and they were faced with the idea that they had to take about a third of a thimbleful, maybe a full thimble, a third of a little shot glass of wine, and they were terrified at the thought that it would open a door that they have five locks on in their mind. And I've had to tell them, you can do it. You can do it. Christ would not give you a responsibility, a command, if he didn't know you had the power to overcome it. I mean, I've watched some of them break into sweat talking to me because they were so concerned about how it could open a door to a prior life. And they've just literally dabbed it on their tongue to satisfy the command. Mr. Armstrong actually made a ruling that was okay to do for some people. But they had to take some, you understand. So, you know, if you're around an alcoholic, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Well, you could cause your brother to stumble. And there are verses about how we don't want to do that, to say the least. Number two, character realizes the importance of little things. Little things matter. Look at Luke 16 and verse 10. On some of these points, we won't turn to a scripture, because we've talked about a number of scriptures, but we will on this one. Luke 16 and verse 10. He that is faithful in that which is least, small, is faithful also in much. If you're faithful in little things, God says, you'll be faithful in big things. No, you don't want to be picky. No, you don't want to see motes in other people's eyes when you have a beam in your own. Remember, we talked about that not long ago. I've been talking to the staff about the importance of following through. We have a wonderful, wonderful responsibility and an enormous blessing and privilege to work in the work. I feel blessed and privileged every day to be here. But, you know, there's a lot of little things that have to be done, and we'd all like to be out preaching the gospel to the world and doing powerful things like Stephen, mighty miracles, and standing and giving a sermon to the Pharisees or whatever, but sometimes it's just sweeping the floor. Sometimes it's doing the dishes. Sometimes it's sitting there and putting stamp after stamp on envelope after envelope. And sometimes it's just folding one piece of paper only to reach for another one and fold it again and fold it again. You know what? God is counting all of that. He's counting every last bit of it. Doing a big work, doing a single big work, is made up of thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of single, individual, little acts or actions. The only way you're going to ever do a big work is if you're faithful in little things over and over and over and over again. And you know what? God says, you qualify for big things. Some people think they qualify for big things only if they say, I can do big things, now give me big things to do in life. And I don't just mean the work. Character realizes the importance of little things. Whether it's cleaning up the hall after Sabbath services. It doesn't say, well, everybody else will do it. Offerings or whatever. You think of little things that don't seem to count. And you'll find that they do. Character, when in doubt, doesn't do it. Number three, when in doubt, character doesn't do it. Whatsoever is not of faith is sin. Do you know if you doubt that you should do something, if you go ahead, you've sinned. Even if you doubt you shouldn't eat strawberry shortcake, and you eat the strawberry shortcake, you think it's a sin, you know it's a sin because you were willing to override your conscience. You had doubts. Read Romans 14:23 for a principle there. Character, when in doubt, doesn't do it. Number four, character never follows the crowd. Do you know there was actually a law in the Old Testament that was designed to bring riot control to the nation of Israel? God actually had a riot law. He did? God had a riot law? Yes. Here it is. Ready? It's one law. Follow not a multitude to do evil. You don't go burn buildings or loot neighborhoods or turn cars over because you didn't like a verdict or something went wrong. All over the world, economy's bad, the wrong leader got in, and mobs get together. Oh, I think he's guilty. Lynch him. Break into the jail. Never follow the crowd. Now, look, the crowd may be doing something that's far short of some kind of vigilante or civil action or some rebellion in some grand way. The crowd's usually wrong. It's not just they're going into a neighborhood to turn over cars and blow buildings up and shoot people or whatever. Character never follows the crowd. I can almost guarantee you if the crowd's going somewhere, it's wrong. Even in the church, I've almost learned. Probably it's better to say I have learned. I've even talked about it in some of the booklets. I once gave a sermon, a 430 Reasons sermon. One of the points was that you can almost take a look at the two groups, and whichever the big group is, that's the wrong one. Historically, when you study Christianity and there's been apostasies for thousands of years, you'll find invariably it's the big group that go the wrong way. I saw a number of people in the split 2.5 years ago. We don't have to get into the details, but I saw a number of people say, I'm going to look at which group is bigger, and I'm going with the bigger group. I literally, my wife will remember, I said this. I said, honey, you watch. The smaller group will be more right. Well, I thought at the time they were. In the end, it turned out to be a tie, but you understand. Historically, if you had looked at Mr. Armstrong with 19 people leaving Sardis with 120,000, you'd have said, wait a minute, the 19 aren't right, when five of them are his wife and four kids. Mr. Armstrong, his wife and four kids and 13 people are right and 120-some thousand are wrong? No way. Eight people get on an ark and 1 or 2 billion are wrong and 8 people on the ark are right? When you even know some of the 8 and say they've got imperfections, Sodom and Gomorrah are all wrong and 1 guy and his 2 daughters are right and even the wife turns to salt? Character never follows the crowd. The crowd's not going anywhere you want to go, brethren, I'm telling you. Number 5, character acts as though it lives directly in God's presence. Character says, if Jesus Christ was sitting right here beside me, would I be saying what I'm saying? Would I be thinking what I'm thinking? Would I be doing what I'm doing? Colossians 3 and verse 17, let's turn over there. Colossians 3 and verse 17 is a verse that's similar in principle, slightly different. And whatsoever you do, in word or deed, do in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God and the Father by Him. Number 6. And again, I could dwell on these, you understand. But number 6. Character tackles the tough jobs first. It doesn't say, I want to do all the easy stuff. Character says, what's the toughest thing to do? And you work down to the easy stuff. Because then it's fun. Accomplishing's fun. If you've got 5 things to do and you do the toughest one first or last, if you're going to do all 5, you've got to do them. So frankly, in a way, the easiest things to do is get the toughest one out of the way, because if you don't, it's sitting out there in front of you and you're sweating it. Character tackles the tough jobs first. Number 7, character does it today. The Bible says, boast not yourself of tomorrow. Well, I'll do it tomorrow. A lot of people procrastinate. Character says, there's no time like the present. What is right today. Now, you may not be able to do it today, but character, you could then amend it to say, character does it as soon as possible. Now, if it's a decision of right and wrong, it's not a matter of just something you need to do. There's a right thing to do. You want to pay somebody back money. It might take you 2 days to do it. You can't do it today. Then you do it in 2 days. But if it's a matter of right and wrong, an absolute decision facing you then, you do it right now. It does it today. Number 8, character doesn't panic under pressure. The only way to answer and expand on that point would be to take you to 100 verses on faith. and all the verses about don't fret because of things that are done to you or around you or by others or whatever, or circumstances beyond your control. Don't panic under pressure. That's a tough one. When there's a lot of stress and a lot of pressure, it's easy to panic. It's easy to get upset. I know, believe me, it is. I've never felt so much pressure as I've felt in the last 2 years of my life, and yet, strangely enough, the last 2 years of my life's been the most fun. And don't ask me to even explain it to you, but it's true. It's been the hardest and the most fun of my life. I guarantee you my wife would say the same on both of those counts. I know that she would. But I'll tell you, there's been pressure right along with the fun. And it's tough at times, but you walk by faith and not by sight. All of us do. Number 9, character is consistent. It's consistent. The double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. He flops around. You watch people flip, flop, flip, flop, flip, flop. We had a woman come with us last summer. Oh, on fire, on fire. Right before the feast, she wrote and said, I'm quitting. About 3 months later, she wrote back and said, I've changed my mind. I want to come back. By the time I called her, she had changed her mind again, and she had decided to quit. But when I called her, in the middle of the phone call, she changed and came back a third time. And she said, this time I'm here. Then she wrote back and said, I'm having doubts again. Now, that was the fourth time. I'd say I've forgotten here. Anyway, that was three. So then she dropped out for the third time. Then she finally, I called and we had a long talk. And she finally got squared away. And that was 2 months ago. And I got a letter from her this week and she quit. And none of you know her. I don't think a single person who has been restored ever met this woman, because she lived in an isolated place, and this man that she had been with pressured her and pressured her and pressured her and pressured her, and he told her he was a prophet and the day of the Lord started in 1997, and she just absolutely couldn't get it out of her head that we weren't in the day of the Lord. I took her to verse after verse. She thanked me. Now I've got it straight. Flip, flop, flip, flop, flip. And this time she finally just said, I've quit. Of course, she said that before. We'll see. And you try to bear the burdens of the week and help them. But character is consistent. It doesn't say, you know what, I'm going to hold down the drinking, but I'm going to occasionally just have to let myself have those lost weekends. You see, it doesn't do any good if you've been faithful for 40 years in your marriage and then you cheat once and lose your marriage. You see, it's consistent. It stays the same. You know, if you only overeat pie once in your life and have 4 pieces and have a heart attack, or overeat, vomit, suffocate. I mean, you understand my point? You die. Inconsistency or prior consistency won't save you. That's happened to people, by the way. You'd be amazed how many people. They go get drunk one time in college and lose their life. I read about a brilliant young man at MIT who lost his life because he had to pass this hazing and he went into an alcoholic coma and died. Number 10. Character gets the point of correction. I've learned there are some people that just will not be corrected. I wrote a person recently and I said, I need to sit down with you. I didn't even use the word correction. I said, I need to sit down with you. I need to talk with you about how you lead your home. I need to talk with you about it. Didn't say why or how or it's terrible. Quit, just like that. Bang, just quit. And so we periodically do lose people. Lost a few in the last 6 months. Four or five adults we've lost. Number 11. Well, I could spend a lot of time on character gets the point of correction. But brethren, that deserves a whole sermon and one is coming, but I wanted it in the list. Number 11. Character considers others first. Character considers others first. It looks on the things of others. It esteems others better than themselves. It's concerned about others. It's the give way of life we are practicing. We have to copy Christ. Christ gave himself. He thought about others. He didn't walk around constantly thinking about himself. He thought about other people. He was concerned about their needs. Were they happy? Did they understand the truth? Did he give them enough time? He healed them. He resurrected his friend Lazarus. He reassured people. He fed people who were hungry multiple times. He strengthened people who had doubt. He constantly was concerned with other people. And you know what? Not a single one of the people around him had God's Spirit. He didn't say, well, I'm only going to be with people who have God's Spirit. That would have limited him to John the Baptist, and that wouldn't have lasted long because John died pretty fast after Christ's ministry began. considers others first. And finally, 12th and last, character always goes first class. Now, I don't mean flies first class, except rhetorically speaking. Character always goes first class. Mr. Armstrong taught that character includes quality. God is a God of quality. He lives in an environment of quality. He tries to do things in a way that represents quality. We all enjoy quality, but you know, character always takes the classy route. Character always wants to go top shelf. Character always wants to be dignified and above the gutter, above the wrong. You know, you've heard the term, hey, that was first class. That was first class. That's a term that was used 30 and more years ago a lot to describe people who were what we call class acts. You've heard the term, hey, she's a class act. He's a class act. You don't see a lot of class acts anymore. You see a lot of class act ups. Character always goes first class. What's the right thing to do? What's the top shelf approach? Final summary verse. If you're still in Colossians, we haven't turned from Colossians 3. We're still in Colossians 3. Colossians 3:1. If you then be risen with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ sits on the right hand of God. You literally seek things that are up there in heaven where God and Christ are. Set your affection on things above, not on things on the earth. For you are dead. Remember Paul said that? And your life is hid with Christ in God. No wonder Paul identified with Christ in him. He knew his life was hid with Christ in God. When Christ, who is our life, doesn't just control our life, he is our life. That's exactly who Paul identified in him. Christ in him shall appear, then shall you also appear with him in glory. That's if you have built character, sought things above, set your affection on things above. Verse 5, mortify, therefore, your members which are upon earth. Put them to death. You know what rigor mortis is, what a mortuary is, or somebody who is morbid. That means deathly. To mortify means to put to death. You are called by God to go out and literally execute certain problems in your life. Just go, give them the death sentence. Execute them, mortify them. Fornication, uncleanness, inordinate affection, evil concupiscence and covetousness, which is idolatry, and so forth. Verse 8. But now you also put off all these. You know how to put clothes off. Some people know how to put off things they don't want to do. Well, here's some things you're supposed to put off your character. Anger, wrath, malice, blasphemy, filthy communication out of your mouth. Lie not one to another, seeing that you have put off the old man with his deeds. Verse 12, put on. Now, character are things you don't do, and there's things you do do. If you're going to change dirty clothes, you're either going to walk around nude or put something else on. So if you're going to put off dirty conduct, filthy garments, verse 12 tells you what to put on in its place. Therefore, as the elect of God, verse 12, holy and beloved, bowels of mercies, kindness, humbleness of mind, meekness, long-suffering, forbearing one another and forgiving one another, particularly during this Passover season. And if any man have a quarrel against any, even as Christ forgave you, so also do you. Why were you born, brethren? Why was I born? We were born to develop the character of God. For all others hearing this, you are now going out of the days of unleavened bread. Keep building the character of God because you were called to glory and you were called to virtue.